ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We're in Soho, London, and Albert Reid is fresh out of university. He's out on lunch break from a job his heart really isn't in. He goes into his favourite secondhand bookshop and he strikes gold.
It was a book by a French scriptwriter called Jean-Claude Carrière, and he would write scripts for this film director called Louis Buñuel, who was a famous surrealist film director. Every day after they finished filming, they'd retreat to their hotels, and they had this daily exercise. They go to their rooms for an hour, and they forced themselves to come up with a story for a new film. And then they would meet in the bar, and they'd share their ideas, and some of them were good, some of them were bad. But really, what Jean-Claude Carrière said in his book, he said, this was a way of exercising our imagination muscles, because the imagination is a muscle. You've got to work at your imagination. You shouldn't just think of it as something bestowed on you from above. It's something that's within all of us. To learn from stories and history about artists, about scientists, about philosophers, the ways they would develop their own imaginations, the techniques they used. And so that's what the book's about.
You were quite young when you discovered this book, and in fact, it kind of influenced, it changed your life. What did it spark in you?
It sparked a lifelong interest in creativity and in the intersection of business and creativity. How do ideas make money? How do ideas take the world forward? How do you capture ideas in a bottle and generate growth and excitement and happiness and warmth and empathy, all these wonderful things that flow from ideas, which have an effect on the whole world, not just in business, but in science, in invention, elements that flow from the imagination, which that's why it's such an important part of our lives. And we don't talk about it that much.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and on this episode of This Working Life, I'm sitting down with Albert Reid, author of The Imagination Muscle, to hear how we can strengthen this muscle for our working lives. Albert has launched and led businesses for Condé Nast in the UK, across Europe and Asia, overseeing titles such as Vogue, GQ and Vanity Fair.
So I have a kind of dual life in terms of business and writing.
Well, actually, in This Working Life, we've been playing around with the idea of having a portfolio career, Albert, and it sounds like you've got one.
I do, yes. And I'm just shifting my career from being a full-time managing director to being a writer and a non-exec. So a lot of what I want to do and I'm doing at the moment is about thinking about work and about the nature of work, the nature of offices, the nature of idea generation. Because what I was doing at Condé Nast was running a business with titles like Vogue and GQ and Architectural Digest, where ideas and creativity were at the heart of what we did. And every day I was really asking the team, what are the ideas? What's next? What's the next cover of the magazine? What's the idea for the scoop? What's the idea for a new business line? Let's do an event. What sort of event should it be? So every conversation had running through it this seam of creativity and idea generation, because really that was the lifeblood of what we were doing. So it was essential to the business. And I was always interested in how you keep those ideas flowing, what it is that makes ideas, what it is that creates a space where ideas can happen in an office environment.
Sometimes in creative industries, I mean, it can be a bit relentless, can't it? You know, having to find these ideas. So what did you find in the creative process would help people feel comfortable enough to share and generate ideas freely, Albert?
Well, I think it's a very good question. The point for me is creating an atmosphere of psychological safety where people feel able to share ideas one-to-one or in groups. And really, you know, it's difficult in work, because in work, you're in a hierarchy, you know, you want to get promoted, you worry about losing your job. So there's a kind of underlying tension, especially with somebody who has the power over you to direct the course of your life. So you naturally feel nervous of looking stupid, of taking a risk, which may fall flat. But I think the enlightened boss, the enlightened leader of a creative team must allow their teams to take risks, to look stupid. I think bad ideas are very, very important, because a bad idea can lead to a good idea. It can start a conversation. It can take the minds of the people you're with in an unexpected direction.
Yeah, you don't want to be shy about your bad ideas, because then you're starting to filter yourself, aren't you?
You're starting to filter yourself. You're starting to limit yourself. You're starting to keep your ideas within yourself. And really, that doesn't help anyone. And most ideas are bad. Most ideas won't lead anywhere. But occasionally, something, you know, will take you in a new direction. And that's really what creativity is about. And it's about thinking outside of the normal constraints of daily thought.
And every This Working Lifer is now thinking, Albert, how do ideas make money?
Ideas make money. A good idea, you know, you can, if you have a good idea, it travels, it takes flight, it goes viral, whatever the mechanism is. Ideas cut through, you know, there's so much out there that's not interesting. And if you have a good idea, you can cut your marketing budget, because you don't need to pay people to look at what you're doing, because people will naturally find it. And that's really, you know, when it comes to Vogue, if you have an exciting magazine cover, it goes all over the world, you know, and that's something that comes from an idea of a person, a way of producing, of shaping an image, a way of telling a story. There's an idea that makes money. One example.
Have we run out of good ideas? We seem to be just recycling things from the 70s and 80s.
I think ideas are getting harder to come by. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that we are finding it harder to have ideas. There's a piece of research from Stanford that says that to sustain, and this is around R&D, research and development, and the study says that to sustain growth in GDP per person, the amount of research effort has to double every 13 years to offset the difficulty of finding new ideas. And so there is a sense, it's hard to spot the absence of something. But if you look around, certainly in the UK, I don't know what it's like in Australia, one sees all sorts of examples where, you know, you see the same music, you see, you know, the top grossing films, every single one of them was a sequel: Avatar, Top Gun, Jurassic World, Doctor Strange. There's a kind of, you know, repetition of old themes coming through. And I worry that we're not really as imaginative as we used to be, and that we somehow have allowed imagination to be handed over to the experts. We don't imagine enough in our own lives. And I think that's bad for society. I think it's bad for us on an individual level. I think the world needs ideas to move forward, and we need to happen to the world, not to have the world happen to us.
Well, what's been happening, do you think, Albert? Are we too scared? Are we too tired?
I think a few things are happening. I think in science and R&D, there's an argument that we've had all the good ideas, we've taken the low-hanging fruit, and that the strange thing about the world today is there's so much to learn that we become specialists at too young an age. We go into a narrow groove at the age of, in the UK's education system, at 16 or 18, and we don't look across boundaries. Whereas in the 18th and 19th centuries, people would routinely work in science and art at the same time. And you'd have people like Humphrey Davy, who was this famous UK inventor who invented the first electric lamp. He also edited the poetry of Coleridge and Wordsworth. And so this idea of working in electricity and poetry at the same time was something that was a kind of natural thing to do in those days. But now people get, you know, they get completely put into their boxes, and we all become specialists, you know, which is, and this is a great dilemma of modern life, is how do you be a specialist and also see across boundaries? Because that's where the interesting things happen.
So what Albert is talking about here is the dilemma we face between being a generalist and being an expert. We've done an episode on this about what's called the T-shaped worker. So the horizontal line in the capital T is the generalist influence, our broad knowledge and skill sets that feed into the vertical bar, which is our expertise in a discipline. We'll link to that episode in the show notes. Now, back to Albert.
I think the other point is, you know, ideas, we rely too heavily on algorithms and data. You know, we get into sort of feedback loops of thought, and we follow things that we go into these sort of ever decreasing circles of music, of film, of TV, and that ability to be original, to find something out there that wasn't in the world we're in already, I think is another problem.
Well, it was a blockbuster before.
Yes.
So we'll do exactly the same thing, because we know that it'll be a blockbuster.
Yeah. And we have a kind of, it'll doism approach to, you know, we'll go and see a film because we, you know, we'll go and see, and I'm guilty of this myself, we'll go and see Mission Impossible because you saw the last one, it was pretty good, it's okay. You know, there's a sort of adequacy trap. Ideas are good enough.
Mm.
It's a good enough problem. We settle for things that aren't really pushing the boundaries. And that's something that I think is a kind of issue.
So what's imaginative risk then?
Imaginative risk is doing something that's a little bit scary. I mean, if you think of the great artists and writers, they were taking imaginative risks all the time and they were prepared to fail. If you think of David Bowie as an example, he produced some wonderful music, but in between the wonderful music, he produced some terrible music. He sang The Laughing Gnome and he was in a band called The Tin Machine. He had some real highs and lows. And this kind of career arc of success and failure is something that we have to embrace. And I could, you know, one could talk the same thing in business. You think of someone like Steve Jobs, these people who were eminent successes and produced the most radical, interesting work. You know, Steve Jobs produced the Apple Mac and he produced the iPhone, these two world-changing products. But in between, he produced the G4 Cube and the Apple Lisa, these complete duds, these products that almost...
What was the Apple Lisa? I don't even know what that was.
It was a kind of attempt at a sort of big computer that was designed for companies, but it didn't work. It was a disaster. The really successful imaginative people, they know something important. They know that there's more to be lost by not engaging with imaginative risk or of letting the greater achievements slip from their grasp because the attempt wasn't made in the first place. And it's really these frequent attempts at imagining that shakes off the dust and applies the pressure to the ridges of thought. There's a saying by Eleanor Roosevelt who says, do something every day that scares you.
Mm.
And in my book, I take her this line and I say, do one imaginative thing that scares you every day. If you're not used to being creative, just try something, whether it's writing a short story or a drawing or an observation or an idea to change the world around you. Because if you do these small imaginative acts, something awakens in your mind and they make you feel uncomfortable at first. But then when you venture to retrieve the piece of paper, the thing you did that you felt ridiculous doing, you'll find it's not so bad. And something's happened to you and you've become a different sort of, you've subtly become a different person. And really, I think this thing of failing. I'm not saying we should fail in disastrous ways. I'm not saying we should, you know, we should if we run a business, we should kind of
lose money, lose lots of money. Albert told me to.
There's good failure and bad failure, and I think that's an important distinction. There's intelligent failure. You know, someone like Thomas Edison failed all the time, and he said, you know, I didn't fail. I just found a way that something didn't work, and it's an educational process. And life is we're a work in progress, and we must think of ourselves as constantly evolving and trying new things. And that's really why, for me, what makes life exciting and worth living and makes you happy and more alive on an individual level.
If I wanted to work on my imagination muscle, how might habits get in the way?
Habits are good and bad. You know, we need good habits like brushing your teeth and taking exercise. There are things in your day which of course we do. But there's this philosopher, William James, who talks about the gradual constriction of habit. And really, we all, if left alone, we'll more or less form our worldviews by the age of 30. Well, most people's views and their ways of living don't change much after the age of 30. And for me, that is a problem because we need to keep moving. We need to keep changing. We need to keep rethinking ourselves, especially in a world where the world is happening at us. Things are changing around us and we have to respond to the world. We have to be agile in the way that we view the world and we respond to the world. But the way to counter that is to think of ourselves as beginners, as to have one aspect of our lives where we have the mindset of a beginner. Mm. And the thing that always strikes me, and I write about it in The Imagination Muscle, is the number of scientists, the most successful scientists, the scientists who won the Nobel Prize, won the Nobel Prizes, had a disproportionate interest in the arts. They were the ones who really succeeded, who were great scientists, were off more often than not bad artists. You know, Einstein, when he wanted to solve a problem, played the violin.
It's true, he did. Einstein started learning the violin at a young age, and as an adult, he carried a battered violin case wherever he went. He owned several violins throughout his life, but he reportedly gave them all the same nickname, Lena, short for violin.
Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin and won the Nobel Prize, was also an artist. He was a member of something called the Chelsea Arts Club in London, which is this great artistic organization. He wasn't a very good artist. In fact, his art was derided, and people mocked his art. Phew. But by being a bad artist, by taking himself into an area where he was having to struggle a bit, having to open up synapses in the mind, which forced him to think differently, work harder, and then taking back that mindset into his scientific work made him a better scientist. And there are lots of other examples, Richard Feynman and so on, who were like that and who could see the world differently through their art, could see the scientific world in a different way through their art, and also could express it through their art and could use their artistic sensibility to make sense of the world in a scientific way. And for me, that is a way of, we all need to find our beginner's mindset, especially as we get on in life, especially as we mature, especially as we, you know, possibly congeal around certain aspects of life. If you become a senior person in a company, if you become successful, you kind of think to yourself, well, I'm always right. I got to where I'm because I've always had the right answers. And actually, that may not be true anymore. And that's a very, very difficult thing to accept in life, that what got you to where you've got to may not get you to where you want to go next.
And is that why, you know, even though you are highly accomplished in the areas of magazine and being a managing director of Condé Nast, that you have embarked on writing and playing in other fields, Albert? Is this part of you with beginner's mind and flexing that imagination muscle?
It is, in a way, yes. It's important for me on a personal level to keep moving and to keep reinventing myself to a degree. I find it very invigorating to follow new paths of thought and to, you know, take risks sometimes in life and not to grow too comfortable. And I think that is something that for me is important. It's difficult and it requires energy. It requires, you know, a certain mindset. But for me, it keeps me sharp, keeps me going, keeps me alive.
And you described your imagination palette, and one of them was walks at dusk, which I thought sounded very poetic.
Yes.
What are other things that you do?
The thing that I find very useful is working early in the morning, around now, UK time. I go straight from my bed to my desk with a cup of tea, and then I do, before anyone else wakes up in the house, I work for 2 hours. What I don't do is I don't check my email, I don't check the news. Once you've done that, you're finished. It's over. The day has begun. The day is happening to you. And so that waking moment when you're somewhere between the unconscious and the conscious, this kind of fertile territory where your mind is still a little bit sort of tender and you're not so far from your dreams, and yet your mind is, you know, the lucidity is beginning to come through and the consciousness of the day. And so there's this liminal moment, which I find particularly effective for my own imagination. There are lots of examples in history of art writers and artists who would have very quirky ways of stimulating ideas. There's one idea that I used when I was writing my own book. I was reading Goethe's memoirs, and he went to see his friend Schiller, and Schiller was his the great German romantic poet. Goethe, he wasn't in, so Goethe sat at Schiller's desk waiting for him, and he noticed this incredibly powerful smell of something very sour, and he opened a drawer, and there was a drawer of rotten apples, all decomposing in a drawer. And Goethe asked Schiller's wife, "Why has he got all these apples?" And Mrs. Schiller said, "Well, he this smell of the rotten apples sort of stimulates his thought, and when he needs to be stimulated, he opens a drawer, breathes deeply from this drawer." So when I was writing my book, I thought I'd try this and see. So I had a bag of apples decomposing under my desk. After about 6 weeks, I was brave enough to venture under my desk and to take the bag and to breathe deeply in from these decaying apples and breathe in this gas called ethylene. I have to say, it didn't really work for me. I had to go to the window.
Hang on, Albert. Hang on. Let me just... Oh, look. Look at that.
Oh, you got it. Brilliant. You got it out of your bin. It needs a bit longer. It's too...
No, not brown enough.
No, give it another 2 weeks, at least. Anyway, this gas, ethylene, was thought to be... they've recently discovered this gas coming through the rocks in the Delphic Oracle, this mystical woman in ancient Greece who would foretell the future for the. It now emerges that this same gas was coming through the cracks of the rocks in Greece, and they think that's the reason she was able to sort of be transformed into this seer. And then there are lots of other examples of, you know, sitting. Nabokov used to write sitting in the back of his car. You know, after a long car journey, he'd stay in the car and write. He found that stillness after a long journey was a tender moment in it for his mind. What I call in the book these spaces in between, these moments when nothing much happens and yet you feel most alive. And I think those are the moments we have to be careful to preserve, because we so often fill the gaps these days with our mobile phones by checking Instagram or checking our email, and we're losing something in the process of doing that.
Albert, you know, we've got a lot on, and sometimes we're tired and we probably just want to phone it in. So in that tired state, it is quite hard to find the energy to generate ideas, to flex that imagination muscle. So what would you suggest we do to turn this around?
I think it's creating the space in your day. I think it requires discipline. I think the hardest part is just before you begin. It's the hardest part is not picking up your phone. And mobile phones, I think, are a big part of this. I think for children, it's other things. It's gaming, it's television. I think the more we can, even if it's for half an hour a day, the more we can do things which just create a bit of space, whether it's a walk, whether it's with a dog, or whether it's something where you're reading a book. I think it's really taking yourself out of the normal discourse. You know, I think one of the things I say in the book is read what no one else is reading. If you want to be a different sort of person, if you want to stand out from the crowd, if you want to get the job that everybody else wants to get, you have to find your edge. You have to find something that differentiates you from other people. You've got to find something that excites you and brings out the original aspect of who you are, and the special. Everyone has a special element to their lives. And I think that's really requires discipline, it requires energy, it requires curiosity, it requires you to look around you, and it requires you to take the path less trodden. But if you do that for just even a small part of your day, and you build up this routine in your life where you're doing something a little bit different, then I think the rewards are immense.
Well, actually, how did you do that at Condé Nast magazines when there are so many deadlines, I would imagine, with running a magazine? How do you not let the urgency take over and the ideas just dissipate?
Well, you just carve out a space in the morning. You carve out, I would, even during the day, I would take a 15-minute break and go for a walk. I think walking, just getting up from your desk and moving around is vital, even if either on your own or going for a walk around the block, or what I would often do if I had a moment, is I'd walk around the office and go and talk to people. I think the other thing is, it's not just about a solitary experience. It's about random encounters. It's about, for me, one of the great joys of office life, and one of the things that we risk losing in a hybrid working from home environment, is the office encounters, the corridor encounters, those moments in the day when small comments are made which lead you in an unexpected direction. So often I would just walk around the building and walk around the office and chat to people, not just at the people I'd always see in meetings, but people in more junior levels and people who I didn't normally encounter, and say, what are you doing? What's going on? What do you think about this? And inevitably, you learn something and interesting things happen, and they stimulate ideas.
Thank you so much, Albert.
Thanks, Lisa.
Albert Reid, Managing Director of Condé Nast and author of The Imagination Muscle. I'm Lisa Leong. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It's produced by Zoe Ferguson and mixed by Carey Dell. This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Until next time, work it, baby.
ABC Listen, podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.